listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host with the most. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very talented actor, and he's also my cousin. We second cousins?
Yeah.
Second cousins. And this is Chaco Barakieth. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Man, I got it right. That deserves one of these. Oh, yeah. I was worried. You know, there's a lot of Indian names you just can't pronounce.
But you're Malayali. You should be able to say Malayali. Barakieth means north in Malayalam.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You're like the North Star of our family. So, did you grow up? You grew up in Malaysia, correct?
I grew up in Malaysia, but I was actually born in Kerala, India.
Oh, like what part of Kerala?
Imanam.
Oh, like right in the heart.
Yeah, that's where our families come
that's
from.
Right, that's right, that's right. That's where the best food is, too. So, how long were you there for?
Oh, I was just... My mom, as you know, is from India, and she moved to Malaysia when she married Dad, and she went home for a confinement. So I was there for a month and then brought back.
You were there for a month and then you moved to Malaysia?
Yeah, I was just...
born there?
Yeah, I was just born there.
Wow.
And then I spent almost 2 years later when mom was doing her special... She's a pediatrician, so she's specializing in London. She left me with my grandparents in Kerala. So, and we've been going back sort of for Christmas and stuff over the years. So I'm quite familiar with Kerala in particular and India in general.
It's like your roots.
Mm-hmm. So, but I'm Malaysian. I grew up in Malaysia primarily.
So was that a weird transition, or was it like no big deal? Because there are a lot of Indians in Malaysia.
Yeah. We're about 8-9% of the population.
Oh, I thought it would be a lot more.
No.
Because there are a lot of Indians in Malaysia. just in Kuala Lumpur.
Just keep meeting them because you're related to a few of them.
No, but I remember going to the airports and seeing, you know, just tons of Indians everywhere.
They might be in transit from India going somewhere.
Maybe. Yeah, it could be very possible.
But, I mean, Kuala Lumpur, I'm sure the percentage of Indians would be much higher. But overall, in the... the East Coast is primarily Malay. The cities, the urban centers would have more Indians and Chinese. And the rural areas would be more Malays.
Did you go to a boarding school when you were growing up?
Not in Malaysia, but I finished high school in England. So I went the last 2 years of that, I was in a boarding school in England.
And you went to Cambridge, right?
After that, yeah.
That's a huge honor. So you must have had your act together academically. You were I'm going to make sure I have everything dialed in.
A bit of luck, a bit of everything, just being in the right place at the right time. And I don't know.
How was that experience?
It was wonderful. I felt like I was in a film set for 3 years.
Wow.
It's so beautiful. And I was in the third oldest college in Cambridge, founded in 1347, and wow. Geoffrey Chaucer went there. But it's a beautiful old college. So my first year, I lived in the old part of the college. And it's just the buildings and the
history.
Chapel.
Yeah.
Christopher Wren's first chapel is in my college.
That's crazy.
Pembroke College, yeah. It's a beautiful little chapel.
My dad always, in the back of his mind, wanted me to study music in Cambridge because I was so into classical music.
Yeah.
And it's got a huge classical department.
Of course,
it's renowned.
I mean, every college would have choral scholars and organ scholars and stuff like that. Yeah.
I can't imagine the party life is that great, though, or is it?
Oh, it can be good.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I think Cambridge, I hear now they're just so obsessed with academic qualification, your grades and stuff.
Right.
But when I was there, it was really a very rounded kind of experience. So there's, there are garden parties and then I went to study law, but I ended up doing a lot of acting. And the first two terms, and because of the collegiate system, each college has a drama club or society or something. Then there are university drama groups as well. like the Amateur Dramatics Club or the Cambridge University Light Entertainment Society, and then, of course, Footlights. And so the first 2 weeks, you're just auditioning because all the clubs are auditioning for their shows.
And had you been doing this in high school? Did you take drama or any acting classes?
I did. At Haileybury, which is a school I went to in England, I started doing some acting. And then I back in Kuala Lumpur, I did speech and drama sort of as a separate thing outside of school. There wasn't much drama in the school as such, but my parents, you know, had to sort of go and learn the piano. And so Saturdays was like...
But isn't it great that, you know, I find that Asian parents are very good about this, just the whole Asian culture as a whole. They want you to be educated, but they also want you to learn an instrument. They want you to learn a language usually as well. And I think those experiences are super great because I have so many friends that grew up here that they weren't pushed to learn an instrument and they weren't, you know, pushed to kind of like stretch themselves unless it was sports. And so like, you know, it gives you this appreciation of the arts in a way once you're in that kind of cycle.
Yeah, I suppose it was sort of the done thing, but I thought, you know, schools, high schools here would have drama in the schools, and there's always a high school.
I mean, they
play
do, but a lot of the programs are getting cut, you know, because they don't have funding. I went to a school that did have a lot of programs, and we did musicals, we did plays, but a lot of schools sometimes don't have the funding. So a lot of those programs now, especially, are getting cut. But there was a time when there were more of them.
Mm.
So, you know, just being in LA too, I think there's more opportunities just because there's so many acting opportunities to be an extra or to get kid speaking roles or to get an agent is easy as a kid versus an adult, you know, because everybody's just looking for the next cute kid to cast them in something, you know. So in Kuala Lumpur, like what kind of shows or things were you able to do or was that not even an option?
Well, I mean, we did, you know, like the speech and drama thing, we'd have a show at
like
the end
showcase,
of the year
yeah.
and... I think we did Alice in Wonderland once and did a bit of Shakespeare and stuff like that. And then it was, you know, going to England. And then when I came back after I qualified, but when I went to Cambridge, I really got into theater there. And it was like this, oh gosh, this is what I really want to do. I think the pivotal moment was playing Othello in the Cambridge Playroom.
Yeah.
And...
that was my first opera that I did.
Oh, really?
We share that.
Yes.
High five.
Yes, I think I remember
That's
that.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Great story.
Oh,
Desdemona.
Mm.
Yes.
And for the final night, I think my sister was studying in London. She came up with her friends, like a lot of family friends who were studying in London and stuff. And then my girlfriend was there and the friends. And everybody who knew me brought a red carnation. So I had like my own curtain call as Othello.
That's awesome.
And there was carnations raining down on me. And I thought, this is what
You're
I
like,
want
this
to
is,
do.
This is it, right
this
here.
This is what I meant to yes. do. Things have been a bit down.
Well,
since,
you know what, though? You know, sometimes it's those moments of zen where it's like you realize this is as great as it can ever be.
Yeah.
And it's in a small level, but it's everything in those moments. So those are like catalysts to push you to the next level. You know, it's like it gives you, it opens the rabbit hole. You know, that's why.
I guess, yeah. yeah. But it was also, I think that was a role that, you know, once I started doing it, I forgot myself. And it's really when the curtain calls come, I sort of come out. I was almost in a trance. I sort of became.
So you love that transformation.
And, yeah. So that was.
And did you have like, did you do method acting? Did you do. I'm sure you read Uta Hagen, Respect for Acting.
But later, not then. Then it was really just, I mean, I'd done, you know, the speech and drama was a series of courses. You know, you had exams at the end of each year and stuff. So you did some acting and sort of monologues and things like that. But Uta Hagen and stuff came later.
Later, yeah. When people are like, you need to read this book. It'll change your life. And then you're like, this is it. So did you do anything other than Shakespeare? Did you do comedies as well? Did you do the whole spectrum of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, at Cambridge or
yeah,
after?
At Cambridge,
At Cambridge, I was with the Cambridge University Light Entertainment Society, along with Prince Edward. He was
wow.
the same year as
That's
me.
That's crazy.
And,
really?
And we would do... And what... And it was known as Kuehl. So what we would do is we did two things. One was take shows to, like, children's homes and things, you know, like special children, whatever, and old folks homes, and we would entertain
them. That's awesome.
And And then to get money to do that, we would perform at the college balls. So Cambridge, every summer, you have the May balls. And so every college would have a ball, and they'd have all kinds of entertainment. And we had Sade come perform for our college ball. She was just becoming, she wasn't famous yet.
That's crazy.
And she'd just become famous just before she came in. So, you know, that was incredible. We got her cheap. But then we had, like, you know, college
she's one of my
reviews
favorites
and stuff. So we would do, like, satire and sort of more grown-up stuff, but we'd also do shows for kids and things. So that was a lot of fun.
So you've got the full spectrum, the comedy, the drama, the monologues.
I guess, everything. Yeah, maybe too much.
Was there any part of it you didn't love? Because sometimes studying it in school can be like, this is not exactly what I want to do.
Well, I didn't really study full-time drama. I mean, I've since done summer courses and summer programs and things like that. And so studying it, I think pretty much enjoy it. I've been quite lucky that every show I've done has been an enjoyable experience. You know, that hasn't been too many things where I'm just like, oh, I just have to do this for the money, or, you know, I'm committed, but I hate the role, or I hate the people. So generally, I've been quite lucky with what I've done.
Well, speaking of doing it for the money, you became a lawyer.
Yeah.
And what part of law did you kind of emphasize
in? I ended up specializing in medical law. So medical malpractice primarily.
The driest of the dry.
No, actually, there's a lot of drama in it.
Right.
There's a lot of human stories.
Right.
And I think at one time I thought I wanted to become a doctor, and then the thought of doing chemistry and physics and stuff just like,
no. Like, no. I think every Indian thinks about doing medicine.
But I sort of, you know, I used to say I'm a medical legal baby because my father's a lawyer that became a judge, and then mum's a pediatrician. So I was comfortable with the medical world and medical jargon and stuff. So that helped me maybe fall into that sort of specialty. And I quite enjoy. I used to defend doctors. Our main clients at the firm I was with was the insurers for doctors. But I also, through that, became involved with the Malaysian AIDS Council. So in the 90s, AIDS was like a big
huge
deal.
Yeah.
And Malaysia had quite a high rate per capita of HIV infections.
Oh, wow.
From sharing of needles.
Really?
Yeah. So we've got quite a... despite having like the death
Wait,
penalty,
like heroin's like a big thing in Malaysia?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Despite...
That's crazy.
Like a the death penalty for trafficking of drugs. So we had quite a high rate of infection. So it was there was a Malaysian AIDS Council, which was set up to work with NGOs or not-for-profits that are working in the or connected to it. So the Malaysian bar was on the council, and I became the bar's rep.
Wow.
To the AIDS Council, and then ended up chairing their law and ethics committee. It became law, ethics, and human rights, and just fascinating issues about, you know, needle exchange or condom promotion. And being a Muslim country, condoms were, you know, taboo in some instances. But also, you know, dealing with like sex workers, which are illegal, or transsexuals, you know, the vulnerable communities.
Yeah.
And then the LGBT community. And all of that is pretty underground. And so how do you reach out to them? And because they're quite vulnerable to infection. So that was a fascinating experience.
Well, you saw all the tiers of society.
Yeah, because we would have reps from these communities. We would, you know, I'd go out with some of the counselors or whatever into the red light district, and they'd be there with like dildos and condoms, showing like sex workers how to put on a condom properly.
God damn it! Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, you know, there's room for everybody, but sometimes some people are like, I don't play by those rules. So let me, you know, what's really interesting about your story is, you know, a lot of people, they may be in careers that they don't love. So you fell out of love with being a lawyer, right?
Well, it was, I think when I went into law, it was sort of like, okay, the sensible thing to do. If at university, I would have preferred to have studied English literature or history,
right.
But then it was like, and
I think my parents
didn't really push me into it, but my dad was saying, okay, what are you going to do after that? You know, is do you want to become an academic, or, you know, why don't you do law, which is not too far away from right. that, and it gives you a professional qualification. And I think he just said because that's the world that he knew. And okay, but I was sort of doing it because, you know, I didn't really have like a passion for it. And then even after I qualified and stuff, I was like, oh, do I want... And then the medical legal actually I found very interesting.
Right.
But it wasn't a growth area. So as I got more senior, I was under pressure to do, you know, to up my billings and do like corporate litigation and stuff like that, which I didn't really enjoy. I think I had a flair for the medical legal stuff, but the corporate litigation and, you know, very technical documents and things, just like I went, oh.
But the amazing thing is that, like, a lot of people, they either fall numb to that voice or that feeling to leave or to just take a break from it.
Yeah,
and you kind of got to a point where you're like, no, I don't want to do this as much or at all, or shipped.
Yeah, I mean, I was acting on the side. So the English language drama world at the time was sort of semi-professional or, you know, sort of a legacy from the British colonial days. So they'd have, you know, they had at the time, I mean, they've all sort of, but they had the Liberal Arts Society and the Selangor Philharmonic Society, which would do musicals. Liberal arts would do theater, and it was really just for the love of it. And, you know, you sold tickets, but any profits were either given to charity or just put back into the society. So people, everybody had day jobs. And then it started becoming more professional and more demanding. So, and then there were young people coming back who were saying, this is what we want to do for our career. And then, you know, otherwise rehearsals would always be in the evening or at night after working hours and stuff. And so I did that for a while. And then it just got harder to do both. You know, the law, everything became more demanding.
And it's also you find your tribe, you know, once you're around people that you're like, yeah, I think that way too. Mm. I think that's a huge underrated factor because, you know, like when I was studying pre-med and music my freshman year of college. And I was... just by chance, put into a room of, it was a dorm, I mean, an apartment of all music majors. So I was like, this is the wind telling me something, you know? And it was, I asked other music majors when I went to school, oh, so do you have all music majors in your place? And they're like, no, well, I have a biology major. I've got this major. So we were the only all music major apartment with four people. And I kind of was like, okay, this is my chance to kind of embrace this environment, kind of learn from it. And I think maybe when you were doing these shows and around these people, that the thespians, you were like, I feel like-minded with these people. This is more the way that I think about the world or life, or they, you may see things in the same way. Was that an influence or subconsciously?
Yeah, I mean, but I actually like the legal world as well. And I suppose I grew up in it because of my father and stuff. And I'm still fairly close to it.
Right.
And I sometimes host, you know, bar dinners and things like that. And I think especially issues like human rights and things are very dear to me. And I try, you know, I've sometimes, like we have a human rights society called HACAM, and I host...
Does that stand for anything?
Human Rights Society of Malaysia.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've hosted like Facebook Live interviews of like the chairman of the Malaysian Bar or human rights activists and so on. You know, so I try and keep in touch through that.
But you definitely have made a pivot, and now you're embracing being an actor.
It's been quite a long time since I've, you know, left the law, and that I think Singapore was developing as a I think Lee Kuan Yew decreed that Singapore should be no longer be just a big shopping center, but it should be a Renaissance city. And they started putting money into the arts and stuff. And so I started, you know, working in Singapore. And I booked a sitcom called Mr. Kiasu, and I played Mr. Kiasu's boss, who was a Sikh guy called Sabu Singh. And that was a fun show. And it's just had a new lease of life because it's gone... been put on an online portal.
Was that your first kind of foot in the door?
Well, before that, I went down to Singapore and there were like theater companies and things that were set up and they were getting funding and stuff. So they were like, you know, professional theatre companies, unlike in Malaysia. You have the traditional art forms in Malaysia, which happen in the rural areas and things. So that was happening. But in Kuala Lumpur and, you know, the Western concept of theatre, that kind of stuff, in Kuala Lumpur, it was still sort of fairly, you know, people just doing it on the side. But Singapore, with they had a National Arts Council, so that became more professional. And then they also had more English language television and things. So I went around meeting and people say, oh, you know, most of the roles, Singapore is 75% Chinese. So most of the roles are for Chinese and, oh, we don't have someone like you. And then there was like a long-standing series. It's almost like a soap opera, but I think came on twice a week or something. And they were having like, there's a murder trial. And I just went to meet the people at MediaCorp Studios. And they say, oh, you know, we don't have any characters that fit your look and your type and stuff. And then they said, oh, but are you a lawyer? And I said, yes, you are a lawyer. And I said, yes. Oh, well, because we've got this murder trial and we can't cast the lawyer character, the prosecutor. And
you're like, I'm here.
Yeah. This and they said, do you want to just have a go? And I sort of read it. So, oh, my God, you got it, because people have been stumbling over all the legalese and stuff like that.
Wow.
So instead of Henry Ong, he became Mohan Menon or something.
That's awesome.
And that was my first television role. And that was like a recurring, you know, because the trial went on over like four episodes.
You could be a future Malaysian star of a Malaysian Law and Order then. You don't know. We don't know.
Oh, yeah. I actually co-wrote a law dramedy for Malaysian TV.
That's awesome.
And that was that. And I was sort of like the, you know, I was part of a team of writers, but I also tried to ensure that it was authentic, you know, the courtroom scenes and what the lawyers would say and do and things like that.
I don't know if you remember, but I was watching Entrapment a couple months ago. And I, you know, I'd never heard you tell me that you were in that movie.
Well,
and
for all a of minute. A sudden,
yeah, but you know what? You have a speaking role even for a couple minutes. And it's like, I would be wearing that on a t-shirt everywhere I went, because it's such a great movie.
It is.
And, you know, I was like, oh my God. I rewound it like three or four times to make sure it was you. I was like, that's definitely my cousin for sure. And yeah, that must have been a cool experience. Tell me how you got that part.
Oh, I mean, I'm not sure exactly who I got a call, but it must have been because I'm known in the theater world in Kuala Lumpur at the time. And definitely I was still a lawyer and things, but they said there's this role. And there are a few people that were, and they went through so many, you know, the auditions were quite intensive. And then I had to meet the director, the final thing, John Emile, and with Sean Connery.
Right.
He was sort of shooting something with Sean Connery. So, you know, I sort of met him briefly, and then he turned around and talked to me and just said, okay, just, because it was only like two lines or something.
Do you remember your line? I remember your line.
Why are the Americans always in such a hurry?
That's it.
But yeah, it's quite a pivotal moment in the film.
Yeah.
So people
know. Well, it's such an intense scene too, but it was like you were like borderline slapstick with saying that. You're like, it was like a cheeky line. Like at Americans, and
yeah.
It was like, I was like, that's an awesome, it wasn't just a line that's like a passing by line, because it was kind of a very cheeky written line, which I loved. I thought it was so cool, but it was just,
thank you.
I mean, is that on your reel? That's got to be on your reel. You're like, I don't know. It's not on my reel.
I don't think
it should be, because it's awesome. It's such a great movie. And
I think it was on one of my earlier reels, but then it was, you know, on its, you know, we tried to sort of bring in bits of Catherine Zeta-Jones and Sean Connery, and then I say,
right,
this.
Right, right.
You know, the moment leading up to it, because that's when they transfer the money.
Yes.
And that's, you know.
It's such an intense scene. That whole scene is just so awesome. And that's why I was like, I had seen the movie many times, and for some reason, that time I remember that line. I was like, oh my God, that's my cousin. That's that's crazy. So I was like, couldn't wait to ask you about that. I had to. Did you get to meet Sean Connery or anything?
Well, just in that moment, just a brief hello while Johnny me.
See, it's those kind of moments you got to pinch yourself and be like, okay, this is what I love to do. Because you're rubbing shoulders even for a brief second. It's like, oh my God, this is one of those moments. This is why I do what I do.
Yeah.
Even if it's just, you know, the funny thing is a lot of the big stars today, like I'll watch movies and I'll see Bradley Cooper in a quick line in some role that he was forgotten about, you know, 10 years ago or 8 years ago, 5 years ago. And now they're huge stars and they're getting leading roles, but everybody has to start somewhere. That's the one thing Absolutely. I do love. You know what I mean? It's like there is a process you see that it's not just, oh, this person's going to get it on a you know, silver platter and they're off to start.
It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
A lot of people are slogging through it. And then once they become a star, you forget about the journey there.
And I think when you came here a couple years ago, you were a bellhop in a TV show. What was that?
Oh, yes. The Forgotten.
That
was my first TV role in America. Yeah.
And you were here to see it, too.
Yeah. I mean, I had moved here. So I'd come here. I came here initially for some... I think that's when I came to see your band and...
That's right. House of Blues.
Yeah,
I missed that venue, man. Yeah.
I know.
It's sad.
That
it's
was
like,
such a cool place.
You know what? The thing that I love is that there are still great theaters to see shows, great playhouses, but some of the music venues are downsizing or they're changing into something else. It's just a natural order. But, you know, it is refreshing to see when you see people still doing art and putting music in some venue or theater in some, you know, hall of some kind. Because it's like there's nothing greater than seeing people put on something that is heartfelt.
Yeah, and to see the, you know, live theater, live music, because it's there.
It's right in front of you. It's the
best. It's an experience, right? And the
live
audience
energy.
And feeding off from the audience. And so that's a unique moment. You know, it's not something that captured in film and then you see the exact same thing repeated. It's just that moment, you're part of it.
So you've auditioned in Malaysia, you've auditioned in Singapore, you've auditioned in England. Tell me what auditioning in Los Angeles or the U.S. was like for you.
Well, first, it's so difficult to get an audition, right? Because I think the scale of the industry is like mind-boggling.
Right.
You know, coming from Malaysia and Singapore. England, I did stuff at Cambridge and then I was at bar school in London and then I didn't really live in England after that. So I haven't really done stuff there. But I'm sure it's equally, you know, the West End and so on. It's a huge industry and so tough to get roles or the TV world.
Was it overwhelming at first?
Yeah. I mean, it's just the whole, you know, I came here on a summer program. I got a study grant, which was enough to cover a summer program and a little studio in Sherman Oaks, which is where
right
we are
here,
now.
Yeah.
It's come full circle. And it was like an 8-week program and it was called TVI Studios. And it was just one of the best things I've ever done. And I liked New York. I'd gone and done a summer course at the New School in New York.
Yeah, I saw that in your bio.
Yeah. So, which I sort of paid for and stuff. And I just thought, because, you know, I have to do this. I have to study,
right.
You know, because I was doing law and stuff. So, and one of my best friends was wanting to do music and we met in bar school. And I said, look, we'll spend a summer in New York and you do music and I do drama. And we did it.
Awesome.
And I loved New York. And I thought, that's where I want to be. But I thought, you know, I have to give LA a chance. It's the entertainment capital of the world kind of thing. And then came here and did that. And then at the end of it, everybody's like, oh my God, your look and your voice and Indians are in. You should come here. And so then I met a lawyer and found an agent. And then I thought, oh, okay, it's happening.
What was that process like? Did you like send out pictures or did you network or did you meet
somebody? Well, the course at TVI, at the studios, at the end of this 8-week, they had an agent showcase. So I got my agent through that. I had about 2 or 3 agents who were interested in me, but the moment they found out I didn't have papers to work, 2 dropped out. And one, Joel Kleinman, who's since passed on, he had a lot of international actors in a boutique agency called Bayer Kleinman International, BKI. And he said, well, you know, if you want me to sign any papers, I'll do it. And that's how I got my 01.
Wow.
And so...
That's amazing that he did that for you.
Yeah.
Not many agents would stick their neck out like that, that's for sure.
Yeah. And it was him. And initially, I got all the papers together and based on what work I'd done and submitted it. And then nothing happened. And then the lawyer sent it to SAG for SAG to say they support this. And they didn't. And finally, it was they wanted to show that I had work to do here. So then I talked to some directors and stuff and said, yes, we'd like you to be in a show. It's still in development. But that was enough for them to say, we want him, we're considering him for the show. Or the show is, you know, and I had a couple of films or TV shows that were being developed, and that was enough for me to get the O1.
And you have your SAG card, right?
Now I do, yeah.
So explain that. Like, a lot of people don't underestimate how arduous the process can be just to get that SAG card. So tell us, like, what were you an extra? Were you doing speaking roles? Were you?
I got Tuft Hart lead, so that was when. Which can't even remember which role I did it, but it was a role, and they were and the production company is prepared to tell SAG that we want him to become. So I think they have to pay something extra. So it was a role that they felt nobody else could do.
And that's awesome.
Yeah, that was very lucky.
It's a huge blessing.
Yeah.
Most people I know have to do it like they're extras
for enough,
and do they get a voucher, and then they
you have to get three
vouchers.
Actually, I'm out of date.
But yeah, something like that, and then you end up just hoping to get that third voucher, and then you have to have something like $2,500 just to pay for the. So it's gone up. It's gone up quite a bit. Yeah. Used to be like $600 or $500, and now it's I think it's something like $2,500. So I there's always, but you know, it puts you in that upper tier. You have better roles and you have better opportunities and better pay just by having that and being a member in SAG, correct?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's, and it's the whole, and you know, the whole world of the SAG world of screenings and talks and, you know, by other SAG members and stuff. So it's quite amazing.
So you were telling me at lunch the other day, you said, that you've been doing some stuff in Malaysia too. Tell us
a
little about that.
Because mum's not so well, I've been spending more time back home, and that's been good. And I think the whole industry is developing a lot, especially with the English language TV and films is fairly small in Malaysia, and so it's primarily Malay language and some Chinese, but now it's changing. So I've been doing quite a lot of voiceover work. I narrate a History Channel series about the history of Malaysia. So we have about 3 episodes.
You must be learning a lot about Malaysia while you do it too.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff that I knew, but the series actually goes into it in more depth, and you get like sometimes surprising perspectives on things. And the footage has been incredible, because some of the stuff, you know, I think was not available before, but because it's more than 50 years, it's become available, especially from London and stuff, like the Malaysian independence and things like that. So that's been fascinating to see and be a part of.
And when you're doing voiceovers, are you able to see the footage as you're kind of narrating over it? Or not so much?
Not so much, but I would watch it before, or I would get a feel for what the whole thing's about. And then we do it with just the text usually. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, you know, have you ever tried auditioning for Bollywood stuff? I mean, I'm just curious because that's an even bigger industry than Hollywood in some ways.
Yeah, people have asked me that, but you know,
Or is it just like the content doesn't interest you?
No. Well, I quite enjoy it, but I'm not a diehard Bollywood movie fan. I don't speak Hindi, so you know, my Indian language is Malayalam. And I've just thought, you know, it's another super competitive world. And I don't think I have it in me to try and break. And with the language thing, I think I'm more comfortable here, you know, because of my English and stuff, English language, than I would be living in Mumbai, I think.
No, I mean, so, I'm just curious about that scene because I've heard crazy things about the Bollywood scene. There's even more drugs, even more money, even more craziness, because there's so much affluence that is associated with it. It's one of the biggest industries.
Yeah. It's possibly the biggest industry in
I think
the world.
It is. Yeah. It's way bigger than Hollywood by 40%, something crazy like that.
Just from the number
because,
of films that
because more people around the world watch, you know, Bollywood movies than Hollywood movies.
Around the world.
Yeah. Really? Around the world. Wow. Yeah. Which is crazy. I mean, I have friends in Pakistan that they'll watch Bollywood movies, friends in China that watch Bollywood movies. I mean, it's just crazy. And sometimes they'll have subtitles or sometimes...
I think in the Middle East, they like Bollywood movies. Malaysia, Bollywood movies amongst the Malays used to be very big. It's not so much now. But I remember when I was young, I think the Malay community would all be watching Bollywood films and singing Hindi songs and stuff like that.
So let me ask you, when you audition for stuff, because I remember I have an agent that she's every now and then she'll send me out for stuff, and I was like, I don't want to do any catcalls. And one time I went to an Indian audition because they were looking for an Indian. I was like, oh, okay, how many Indians could possibly be in LA? And I walk in and it was just like every Indian in Southern California was sitting in that room. It didn't even matter if they were an actor or not. There were doctors sitting in the room. There were dentists, lawyers, just because their friend told them about this audition. And I was like, never again. I don't want to do this. So I assume when you're walking into a role, I'm sure it's like, you know, South Indian male, you know, whatever the description is for the character. Do you walk in and do you see like 30, 40 people just sitting in the room that you're like, oh man, this is crazy?
It depends. I think if it's for a TV show and stuff, it wouldn't be 30 or 40, but you'd find, yeah, there might be 10 sometimes. You know, it depends what stage. If it's like, sometimes if it's straight to producers, it might just be 3. But commercial auditions, you would find a lot, you know, like see all these people with like lab coats walking by.
Well, you said you did an audition the other day where it was an Afghan warlord, and I'm just picturing you walking in the room and it just looks like the Taliban are just in the waiting room, just hanging about, you know?
Taliban or American soldiers.
Do you ever dress up in characters when you go to auditions?
I mean, they say you shouldn't, you know, it's not a costume party.
Right, right, right.
And I sort of feel that as well. But I suggest it. So, you know, grew out my beard as much as I could in the time that I had for the audition which suggested the
right.
role.
You're like, I know what they're looking for. I got to just make sure this beard comes through. And what's like the most obnoxious thing you had to do in an audition room? Whether it's a cold call, cold reading, or something, did they ever ask you to do something like a stark contrast to what they were looking for? What's the craziest thing you've had to do in an audition?
Oh, gosh. About audition, but once I did in Singapore, there was a series where it was Shakespeare stories, but in modern times, you know, in a modern setting. And I played Othello. But he was like a football coach. Can't play football. And that was... unfortunately, they didn't ask me to like kick a ball for the audition. And I think I got... Because the producer, writer knew me and thought, oh, he's perfect. But it was a modern setting, modern day Singapore. But then later in the shoot, I had to kick football and stuff, and I was so bad at it. It was
you're like, this is embarrassing.
I was so embarrassed. I was mortified.
Yeah, you've done quite a bit of stage plays.
Yeah.
You played Gandhi in something recently, right?
Well, not recently, a few years ago when I was sort of based in LA full time at the Steve Allen Theater. Yeah.
Tell me what that process was like, too. I mean, he's like the Indian Martin Luther King for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's quite an amazing. I sort of that was the Meeting of Minds. It was a TV show that Steve Allen hosted. And then there's a theater named after him, which belonged to his family, but the whole theater's gone.
Wow,
it was
really?
In East Hollywood. Yeah, right by, just before you get to Los Feliz. And it was a beautiful theater with lovely grounds. And I've just heard it's been torn down. It's going to be an apartment block or condominiums or something. But they, the directors, Frank McNair and his wife, Dee Dee, they got these scripts for the Meeting of Minds, the TV show, and they put it on stage. So it would be, and Jack Maxwell was the guy who played Steve Allen,
So it was the actual transcripts?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Steve Allen would put people from history. It's like if people from history came on a talk show,
right,
what would they talk about? And so we had Gandhi and Adam Smith, who's like the father of capitalism.
Yeah.
So they clashed, you know. So,
wow.
So she, and then it was this, I can't remember, nurse from New York who really started contraception. And again, Gandhi's about celibacy and she's about contraception. So very interesting dialogue. But it was also, you know, and one of the things that the show reveals is why Gandhi was so obsessed with celibacy was that, you know, as a young newly married guy, he was enjoying his sexual life.
Right.
But his father was dying and they lived in this extended family home where, you know, the whole family lived there. And they had like shift duty to sit with the dying father.
Right.
And when he was on duty, I think he was feeling a bit horny. So he asked his uncle to cover for him. And he was having sex with his wife when he got a knock on the door saying, your father just died.
Wow.
And I think he never got over that.
That is crazy.
Yeah. So that, and then he went into this, I'm not sure whether he did it immediately, but you know, then for much of his life.
I didn't know any part of that story. That's crazy.
Much of his life, he was celibate, and then he would test himself. So he used to sleep with young girls on either side of him who were naked. And that was like a slightly, and when I was researching the role, I was shocked at how many websites there are, like from Pakistan and stuff, saying he's a pervert, he's disgusting, he slept with naked girls. And, you know, so that was like a whole, you know, because otherwise he's such a revered
right
character in the Indian
world.
That's
like the man versus myth concept.
Yeah. But it was, I mean, I really found it fascinating getting into his character.
So did you take that perspective when you were acting as Gandhi? Did you kind of, you know, try to act on the duality of being conflicted?
Yeah, I think that because he, you know, it was a talk show, so it was the concept. But yeah, I mean, the pain of, because there he talks about, you know, this moment and getting the knock on the door and how he would have been by his father's side. And his father drew his last breath, and he never forgave himself for that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's a crazy story. I've never heard that story.
Okay, I discovered that when I knew about the naked girls and stuff, but I didn't know about why he was so obsessed with
Gandhi, you little devil, you! Now, an interesting part of your career, too, you've been hosting events.
Yeah.
You recently hosted an Oscar event for lawyers, entertainment lawyers, right?
Well, it wasn't an Oscar event. It was an awards night for the lawyers during the awards season. So it's the Association of Media and Entertainment Council, AMEC, and so entertainment lawyers, and they get awards. So it's your peers recognizing your work in different categories. So whether it's music law or sports law or
those are like your two worlds coming together.
Yes, so that's quite it's quite nice that my two worlds of acting and the law sort of came together in that role.
Are you ever in a situation when you've done a hosting gig and they're like, just riff for a little bit? What do you do in those situations?
Oh, it can happen. Yeah.
Do you have jokes pen up? Or do you have audience participation kind of gags or things?
Not so much audience, but I try and comment about what's happened before or what's, you know, what we're going to have, or, you know, it just depends. I mean, like here, I mean, it wasn't really to cover, but, you know, some of the, on the spur of the moment things, they did a whole segment on Netflix and how they have this very cool, innovative way of training their lawyers. They had a little video about it and stuff. And so I said, well, you know, that's how you get not one, but not two. They had three films for best film for the Oscars. So that's how you get three films nominated for Best Picture. Nurture your lawyers.
It's very true. But, you know, that's a big part of entertainment.
Yeah, and I think it's lawyers, you know, for better or worse, are largely sort of forgotten or ignored, but they're a vital necessity. And, you know, the famous line from Shakespeare saying, the first thing you do is kill all the lawyers. But
it's a little morbid.
That's always quoted at lawyers, but in a way, I mean, it can be interpreted differently, but I think the way lawyers like to interpret it is that what Shakespeare is saying is, if you want chaos, and mayhem, then the first thing you do is kill all the lawyers.
Because... Dang!
So do you do the hosting gig for other, you know, other kind of ventures?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's sort of my bread and butter, along with I do a lot of voiceovers for commercials back home. And I do, I mean, emceeing or hosting. So I did, like, when Prince Charles and Camilla came to Malaysia, I hosted the Royal Gala dinner.
That's awesome.
That was quite a, the British Council, the British High Commission
That must have been such a huge honor.
It was. It was quite an experience.
Were they sitting right next to you when you were doing some of
that? I'm in front, at a podium, right. And they were like, because in Malaysia, we've got 9 royal families because there are 9 sultanates which
right.
came together along with a few other states to form Malaysia. So you had, you know, different sultans, and each of them have a different way of addressing them and stuff. So the protocol was like a nightmare.
Wow. Explain that.
It's just how you address them, you know, at the beginning. So we had to do the opening address to the Malay sultans. You do it in Malay.
Wow.
And it's sort of a very sort of flowery Malay language. It's only used for royalty. So I had a co-host.
In 2 languages. Yes,
so we did, yeah. So we have to do the opening salutations to the Malay royalty in Malay. And then you get permission, you ask for permission to continue in English. And then you continue, and then you greet Charles and Camilla.
What if they're like, no, I don't give you permission?
And the thing is, like, at rehearsal, I kept saying Charles and Diana.
So wow,
I
can't oh say my
that.
God.
Because that's, it just seems
right.
to flow.
Right, of course.
But I mean, I wouldn't say Charles and Camilla, or Charles and, you know, His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, and Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Sussex.
That's got to be a little nerve-wracking to host an event like where you have so many dignitaries, just all eyes on you. And you're like, don't mess up. So let me ask you this, too. So now you've written some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You've acted in TV shows. You've done some voiceover. Do you find that it's the spectrum of doing it all that you find complete fulfillment, or is there something that you feel like you would rather be driving the bus doing one of them more than any of the others?
I think I like variety. So people say, do you prefer comedy or drama? And I definitely think it was just doing drama all the time, it would get really heavy. And comedy is such a joy to do, and making people laugh, you know. And
absolutely.
I had a guest role on Rules of Engagement, and that was like, and that was that sort of, because I think my first love is being on stage,
right,
and
right.
and, you know, just connecting with an audience, and that they shoot
in front of a studio audience,
yeah. and you have like a rehearsal process, so it's like 5 days of rehearsal and or 4 days of rehearsal, on the fifth day you actually shoot, so it's a whole week, like Monday to Friday, and that was wonderful. And every day, you know, I'd go on to the lot on Sony, and you just enter the soundstage and you just hear laughter because people are trying out different lines, and, you know, and everybody's just laughing, and it was just such a joy.
You're like, this is it right here. It's that sound. It's the sound of people laughing that you feel like there's a dialogue, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it just makes you feel good. And when it's good comedy and good humor, but I think, you know, drama is also wonderful because it's the real human story, and it can be cathartic, and, you know, connecting people's emotions. And
that's why we need both. We need both faces.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the face of comedy and the face of drama, right? So what's next for you? Do you know, or are you just auditioning and just kind of feeling things out?
Well, I've had a few auditions here, and I came to do the thing, but I'm heading back to Kuala Lumpur, and I'm facilitating a press conference for he's called a living treasure of Malaysia. He's Ramli Ibrahim, who's a dancer. He's a Malay male dancer, but he's one of the world's top exponents of Odissi dance, which is a classical Indian dance form. So he's got a big show coming up at the end of March. So I think on the 4th of March, he's got a big press conference about it. So I'll be
the MC.
Facilitating that, the MC.
Kind awesome.
Of so, and I've worked with him. I've narrated for his shows, and I've MC'd events for him and stuff. So it'd be nice to be going back and doing that for him.
Well, you have to come back, man.
Mm.
You know what? You've got an interesting story.
Well, I think it'll be easier now that there's more auditions on tape.
Right.
You know, I think it'll be easier to...
To do more international projects.
Yeah. And so I had a really good meeting at Paramount through, you know, from somebody who saw me at the AMEC as a host at the AMEC, and they said, you have to meet the casting people at Paramount. And, you know,
you're like, yes, please.
Yes, of course. I'd love
to throw
me
in the mix.
And things like that. So, you know, and people seem more open to. So if it's like a straight producer's kind of audition and you can do it on tape and then they confirm the job, then I'd be happy to fly back to do it.
Where can people find you if they want to cast you in something?
I have a website.
So what is it?
ChakoVaraketh.com.
You're going to have to spell that out because there's a lot of consonants in
there. I know. It's Chako, which is, I always say it's like Wacko with a C-H. So it's C-H-A-C-K-O, Varaketh, which is V for Victoria, A, D for Denmark, A-K-E-T-H.com, ChakoVaraketh.com.
You know, my brother's middle name is Chako.
Yeah, it's one of the most popular names in the Syrian Christian community of Kerala. It means Jacob.
See, I knew my dad had to slip his little influence. Anyways, Chako, you have been an awesome guest.
Oh, it's been wonderful to be here.
You have to come back. You have to come back. And we usually like to bring everybody back within like 9 or 10 months. So next time you have some more gigs out here and more stories to tell, please come back and share them with us.
I'd love to be here. Thank you.
On behalf of Eddie, myself, and Ronen, we'll see you guys here next week.